Value creation has always been a cornerstone of the private equity industry, but perhaps never more so than in the current decade. From COVID to geopolitics, the events of the last 6 years have prompted private equity firms to reimagine and refocus their value creation functions, as well as the levers they pull to drive portfolio company growth. Operational levers such as procurement, supply chain resilience, and talent management have come to the fore, while technology, particularly artificial intelligence, has become an ever greater area of focus. According to a recent KPMG survey, 77% of private equity leaders say AI is a top investment priority. But ensuring AI investment translates into growth at the portfolio company level is easier said than done. I'm Louise Fordham, Head of Special Projects for the Private Equity Group at PEI. In this special episode, sponsored by Cinven and KPMG, we'll explore how operating teams are addressing these macro issues and what the future holds for value creation strategies more broadly. I'm joined by Paul Pan, private equity leader for the deal advisory and strategy practice at KPMG, and Sam Williams, managing director of strategy and investment insights at international private equity firm Cinven. Here's our conversation. So hi, Paul. Hi, Sam. Welcome to Private Equity Spotlight. I'd like to kick off today's discussion with a bit of context. So we're currently in a period of heightened macroeconomic and geopolitical uncertainty. But what does that uncertainty really mean for the future of value creation in private equity? Paul, perhaps we could come to you first here. How are you seeing private equity sponsors make sure their portfolio companies are resilient to near-term shocks given the current environment?
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like we're in a period of near-term shocks every 4 or 5 years, right? So if you factor in the scenarios with Brexit in Europe, the uncertain tariff situation that we've been in the last 2-3 years, plus now this latest event, I think it really just highlights how much upfront scenario planning, visibility into your supply chain, visibility into how you sort of interact with the market is needed. So even when we were advising clients on the uncertain tariff situation, the sort of winners or losers of those scenarios really depended on how much visibility you had into your inputs and outputs, all the way down to, you know, when we look at tax commodity codes and sub-commodity codes, right? Really, what are you buying? What's coming in? And having that ability to then scenario plan and take almost pre-planned actions on options that you could take in these events, right? So the more sort of visibility you have, the more you can do that planning.
Great. Thank you, Paul. And Sam, what's your take on this? How is Cinven approaching these kinds of issues?
So I think, as Paul said, look, I think we're starting to see volatility as, you know, no longer being cyclical, but more structural. It's been really a feature of the past few years. And obviously, it's got massive implications for what we've been doing at Cinven. I sit as an observer to the Portfolio Review Committee at Cinven as part of my role. And so I've been very involved in our response to a lot of the events that we've seen over the past few years. And I think the first step for us is always to triage, you know, the impact. What are we seeing across our portfolio in terms of direct impact and also indirect implications that we need to be thinking about? So we set up a working group, a control tower, effectively centrally at Cinven. And then we work as part of that group in very close liaison with the Portfolio Review Committee and our portfolio team to move pretty quickly then to mitigation. Once we've understood the problem set, how can we start helping our portfolio companies on the ground to mitigate the impact of that event and what we're seeing? So, for example, take tariffs. Paul mentioned it. You know, we established a tariff working group very, very quickly. And then we started to work with our portfolio company management teams. We put together a microsite, drawing upon our advisor network, getting them the right insights to think about this problem set, and then getting them together on a series of webinars to start sharing best practices across the group with each other so that they could start taking these ideas and scaling them into action. So we think that's really important in terms of our platform and being able to really bring everybody up to speed on what the market is thinking and doing, and then getting really practical about how we can start dealing with some of these things. Something that struck me as we think about volatility and as we think about how we've responded is actually how far we've come since the Russian invasion of Ukraine to today, you know, with the situation in Iran. We're expecting an energy price shock. We're seeing an energy price shock in the oil price off the back of the situation in Iran. But when we went out to our portfolio to think about direct and indirect implications of the situation, what we're seeing is a much greater penetration of hedging, forward buying of energy across the portfolio. For example, RB Europe, that runs the Burger King, Popeye and Tim Hortons brands in Southern Europe. You know, we've got 80% of our energy costs fixed into the next decade there through a long-term purchase price agreement. So it's measures like that that we've taken through time that really add resilience.
Sam, perhaps you could explain a bit more about how portfolio-wide strategies can play a role in mitigating some of the other issues that companies are facing right now.
A topic close to my heart is our group buying platform, our group procurement initiative that we launched in 2023, based on a pretty simple thesis of bringing together the combined scale of our portfolio and going to markets to be more efficient effectively in our indirect spend. And what that's done, you know, a great recent example of the power of that platform is an ocean freight tender that we've done. You know, it's delivered high single-digit million cost savings, but more than that, it's also made us much more relevant to the freight forwarders in that space. And therefore, when we've seen supply chain disruption as a consequence of the situation in Iran, we've been able to mitigate that, given the relationships we have with the largest freight forwarders globally. And we've still been able to get product into the UAE, for example, for one of our portfolio companies through those arrangements, and pricing has been maintained because the contracts were essentially built for disrupted and volatile situations. So that's pretty tangible and something that we're, you know, pretty proud of in terms of the how we can harness the power of our global portfolio.
So we've touched on how to help businesses manage energy costs, as well as the importance of supply chain planning and visibility. But what about pricing? Sam, would you say pricing optimization strategies are gaining traction given the current macro context?
Yeah, so I think, you know, another area that's really evolved over the last few years is, you know, the level of sophistication that we're seeing in tying the cost of inputs to the price of outputs in order to protect margins. So that's clear. And, you know, there's a lot of sophistication in the portfolio. I'm always reminded of a good example from TKE, where their new installation order intake quotes are only valid for 24 hours after they've been made. So that is, you know, one of the key measures for resilience that we have within that portfolio company. And we see that quite commonly across the platform from a good pricing discipline perspective.
And Paul, what's your take on pricing strategies in light of the current uncertainty? Are you seeing something similar to Sam?
You know, pricing really is a relation of like where you, again, are in the ecosystem, right? So when there's uncertainties in supply chain and uncertainties in sort of pricing of inputs, you really have to understand contractually, right? So it sounds very basic, but down to the tenets of what your terms and conditions are. What are the things you can push in terms of pass-through cost? Now, whether or not you want to exercise those terms in the contract, that's a business decision for the portfolio companies and the management teams to make. But really that first tenet is, I understand what my options are based on the contractual terms that I have and where I sit in that ecosystem. And I think that's both on the front of not only understanding the contractual terms of things like pass-through pricing, if I get an increase on my input, can I pass it through to the customer? And then again, obviously a business decision on whether or not you want to exercise that, but even more on the optionality of, can I change some of the input and still meet the requirements and the specs of the contract? We see a lot of times when we're chatting about almost planning for kind of cyclical shocks, to Sam's earlier point, coming through the system, there's no better way of being sort of the most nimble in the ecosystem than having the ability to understand your terms and like where your position is, and then being able to apply that in, you know, scenarios moving forward.
So the next topic I'd like to move on to is artificial intelligence. And that's because AI can be seen as a cause of disruption and therefore something you might need to consider from a resilience standpoint, but it can also be seen as a growth driver. Sam, how do you think advances in AI will change operating partners and also portfolio company strategies for implementing it? And going beyond that, what do you think AI as a value creation lever will look like in the future?
I mean, look, I think it's been a very fast moving area, clearly. And I think we have seen, you know, a bit of an inflection point over the last 12 months as the technology's evolved and the tooling has changed in a way that it's really now a really tangible productivity tool. So, you know, this is now firmly on the board agenda across the portfolio. And I think it's going to make a big difference, you know, in terms of the way that we think about value creation going forward. You know, we think about it through two lenses, I think, at Cinven: resilience and opportunity. And clearly, from a resilience perspective, AI can be a source of disruption, as you said. And so we assess that really systematically at the portfolio review committee. And we're looking to embed AI across our portfolio. We think that's a really important way that you build resilience to this disruption, is by getting ahead and really embedding best practice throughout the portfolio. But on the opportunity side, we think this is really huge. You know, we've got a team of professionals focused on AI within Cinven, focused on our portfolio, and we see this as a €1 billion value creation opportunity. And, you know, that's pretty tangible. And we see that really across three areas: AI within the product, it's AI within the front office, and then it's AI within the back office. So the first two being real differentiators and growth levers, and then the latter being a margin opportunity, which is huge and helps to decouple that revenue growth from the growth in operating costs and also pay for the investment in the first two pillars as well.
Thank you, Sam. And Paul, does that chime with what you're seeing in the market?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just sort of fear AI and the disruption is probably not the right approach. I, you know, love how Sam sort of mentioned the two sides of it, also being sort of that opportunity and also being that risk, right? And you got to find sort of that fine balance between the two. And really often, to Sam's point around front office and back office, I would say we get asked those two questions almost a little bit in silo sometimes, right? Hey, can you evaluate my product stack and how I'm going to market and how my product positioning fits in market? Do I have risk and opportunities there? And then also on the back office side around, hey, what is my operating model? What is my operating platform? Have I fully sort of embedded AI into it, right? So on that back office side, really understanding, hey, when you're setting an operating model, when you're making investments in your platform, is it aligned to where you think AI is going to be able to, you know, make it more efficient and sort of change how you work from a back office platform? And I do think that front office and back office is starting to merge a little bit, but almost having that operating platform that has embedded AI into it has then become a competitive advantage for that front office. And the way you innovate your product, the speed you innovate your product, the turns you're able to make, and the efficiency you're able to push the product out in the market, which ultimately becomes a front office advantage stemming from the back office.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Paul, you know, it sort of brought to mind an example from our portfolio, Archer, which is our compliance and risk management platform in the US. You know, we have, through an acquisition, integrated AI pretty deeply into the product at Archer. We now enabled essentially real-time scanning of regulatory developments for our customer sets, such that they can see what's coming and how it'll impact their business, as I say, in real time, driven by AI, which is a real differentiator for the product and a real growth driver for us. So I totally agree with you in terms of the importance of augmenting your product set and how that can really, really turbocharge that growth set. And then, you know, on the back office, we find that very, very exciting because it's also something that we think is very replicable across our full portfolio. So it's an area that we're investing pretty significantly from a playbook perspective to ensure that, you know, we can rinse and repeat where appropriate right through the portfolio. So I think, Louise, you asked how you expected AI to impact the kind of approach to value creation. Well, I think, you know, the key thing for us there is that this is a disruptive technology. It's a productivity enhancing technology, but change management is absolutely fundamental to this. So we need to have the right talent around that and the right change management practices to really embed the technology, drive adoption, monitor that adoption, and really drive that productivity or top line enhancement through the system. So that talent ecosystem's never been more important to make it work.
Great. I wanted to ask what the blockers are when it comes to realizing AI's potential and how to mitigate those. It sounds like change management is really key here from what you've said. Paul, what else do you think should be considered?
It's data accuracy, data governance. And I also think around just the people element of it, right? Change management is a portion of it, but there's a level of sort of upscaling and education that needs to go in place before you sort of embed and say, oh, I'm going to start measuring AI adoption. A lot of times I think we've seen that missing gap where it's, hey, look, we have the tool, you know, we have the data. Like, why is our adoption of this? Like, why isn't it driving the metrics and the impact? It's that really kind of readying the team members by function, by geography, by sort of what they do on a daily basis to be able to then drive that the AI adoption, which is, I mean, again, at KPMG, I mean, we're sort of measuring it every day for our own practitioners, and that sort of education layer is really key.
Yeah, fully agree with that. I think it's really about driving that AI first culture, ensuring that before you do anything else, you think, how could AI augment or support this process, and really driving that kind of mindset. But it's really classic change management at that point, and it's just super important.
Great. Thank you both very much. Let's turn now to how sponsors are creating runways for growth within their portfolio companies. So what kinds of initiatives should operating partners and portfolio management teams be focusing on to build long-term sustainable growth? Sam, perhaps we can come to you first. What do you see as the focus areas?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Louise. So look, I think for us, when we think about kind of creating long-term sustainable growth, I think, you know, for us, it's about strategic transformation. It's about that kind of full agenda versus, you know, individual tactical initiatives. You know, it's about the product, it's about the technology, it's about the operational platform. And I think, you know, we have a favorite saying at Cinven, that a good business is not necessarily a good investment. So for us, it's all about exit as well. So everything that we do is steered towards what the potential buyer pool are focused on, what they want to see, and what will make this business as sought after as we can possibly make it. So I think in that light, and then obviously you've got to look at it in terms of the current environment. So, you know, you're thinking about what kind of levers can help build resilience in a portfolio company. As I say, the buyer pool, but you're also thinking about, you know, how can we do things more efficiently from a growth perspective as well, which is where AI can really help. So we spoke about supply chains, and so resilience is obviously absolutely critical there. You know, it's not just about price of input, it is about that continuity of supply as well, and that quality of operations. So when you think about enabling growth, that quality of operations is super important, you know, with dual sourcing, with regional production for regional customers, so you're not too dependent on any one portion of the global supply chain, given the new world that we find ourselves in. And we've done that really well at our businesses that have a physical footprint and sell goods as opposed to services. You know, I think otherwise, in terms of growth, you do have your classic levers, go-to-market, Salesforce effectiveness, but they're very much augmented by technology. And I think product has just become more and more important as well in terms of your differentiation and how you augment it and how you ensure that it stays differentiated going forward, because things are evolving so, so rapidly.
And Paul, what's your take on the value creation levers that will be important for long-term growth within the portfolio? And more importantly, what's needed to make sure those levers are pulled successfully?
Yeah, I think it really falls on two elements. One is understanding your platform and why it's differentiated. So is it differentiated and it allows you to do product line extensions really well? Does it allow you to do geographic and regional extensions of your core products? That's really one side of it, understanding your platform and what differentiates it to allow you to drive, you know, growth and execute your growth plan. I think even more so is on the innovation cycle, right? And the ability to sort of reach into the organization, have a process that allows you to understand what are the ideas coming from the organization, constantly filling in that funnel in the pipeline and going through a fairly stage gate process. A way to, you know, evaluate, fail fast, you know, cancel programs that aren't working, and then ultimately get to a good result and good probability pipeline. I think the classic case of growth and sort of creating that platform and creating innovation is typically seen on some of these, you know, platform plays where you are taking something, you're establishing and certifying that platform and creating differentiation in that platform, and then doing bolt-on acquisitions, right? But it can also come in the flavor of investments that look more like innovation-driven and fast cycle-driven innovation. So those are really the two keys. And then you embed what are the levers that we think we're good at based on those two and drive that as quickly as possible.
And just thinking about some of the other typical value creation levers, do you think refinancing is still an effective lever in the current environment? Sam, perhaps we can come to you here.
I mean, I think refinancing has been, you know, we've got an absolutely fantastic capital markets team at Cinven, and we have actually done 300 million euros of annual interest savings in 30 refinancings or repricings since 2024.
So we've really been capitalizing. We've been very proactive in capitalizing on the tight spreads that we've seen over the past couple of years. Clearly, the financing market continues to evolve and there's pockets of pressure, you know, in and around the tech space. But broadly speaking, that's been a fantastic value lever for us. We expect that to continue. And it's been a great growth enabler for us, clearly, as well. You're able to utilize those interest cost savings to invest for further growth within the portfolio. So yeah, we've seen that as a great lever. And, you know, we're also continuing to hedge our interest rate exposure as well, taking another spin on what the capital markets team are doing. You know, they're building resilience within the portfolio. In that way as well, we always like to be more than 50% fixed or hedged for the next 2 years across our portfolio. So there's a lot of value to be added on the financing side for sure.
Sam, it's always a balancing act between cost of capital from a refinancing side versus capital availability to go really drive your medium and longer term growth, right? You never want the management team to feel like they're constrained by that piece of it. So I think a lot of times when we're supporting clients doing that, the first question we always ask back is, okay, well, have you optimized just broader working capital, right? Like, is there a way to sort of free up capital from your existing structure before you get into that? Okay, how do I balance cost of capital and availability of capital? Like, can you get working capital from your existing ecosystem? But obviously a place that will continue to have, you know, opportunities and say like a point of differentiation, like for Porcos, where, you know, Sam and the funds sort of allow them or give them the playbook, right, to optimize those three things.
In light of the value creation priorities we've discussed today so far, how do you see the way operating teams are structured and the way that they engage with portfolio company management changing to better align with those priorities? Paul, perhaps you could share your thoughts first, and then Sam, I'd be interested to hear a bit more about how Cinven's operating partner bench has evolved.
Yeah, I think it ultimately comes down to like, how do you align motivation and incentive structures right around the three legs of the stool: deal partners, operating partners, and, you know, management teams at portfolio companies. You know, I do think in the world of exits becoming a little bit less traditional, meaning like it's no longer, hey, you acquire an asset and you've got 5 years to implement a VCP and then you do a full exit, like in, you know, that 5 to 6 year timeframe. We're living really in a world where keeping optionality in different phases of exits, it could be partial exits, a carve out of a business unit, you know, the rest of the business goes into a continuation fund and you sort of continue to invest in that cycle. This cycle of partial exits and dual processes for how to exit really then centers back on, well, are the management teams, are the operating partners, are the deal partners, are they all fully aligned in terms of motivations and timing of these things? We've seen more often than not the need, I think, in the last few years to go revisit management team incentive and compensation structures, similar for operating partners as well, right? But the ability to sort of maintain that flexibility is great, but having the alignment on those three groups so that if you have a partial exit, it isn't just good for one group and not good for the other, or could even be bad for the other, to be able to really get that tightly aligned.
And Sam, how's the operating team function changed within Cinven?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the operating team function is really critical to what we do, obviously, as alpha investors. So we continue to invest in the core operating partner area where, you know, these are very kind of experienced generalist players who have typically had top tier consulting and then corporate experience, but they typically do have that functional spike. So they're generalists, they're strategic architects, but they've got that functional spike, whether that be in procurement or go to market. And we've augmented that pool. We've grown that pool, but we've also augmented that pool with functional expertise. So whether that be in the sphere of sustainability or AI and data and digital, we've made big investments there. We've also invested into my team, the investment insights team, to focus on the investment committee process and the portfolio review committee process. And we spend a lot of time on exits within that as well. So we've added that functional expertise to that kind of strategic orchestration layer, I would say. And I think that's going to be a big theme going forward, you know, in a world that I think just requires more agility. You're going to need that functional spike as an operating partner within your capability set, so you're sufficiently deep in the area that you specialize in. And so you can really focus on the portion and subset of the portfolio that needs your skill set. And then you can bring in the real deep technical expertise to help drive change alongside you. that's what we're seeing in terms of the shape of the team. I think the other thing that we're seeing, you know, when you take that beyond just the individuals and the talent, is the amount of work we've put into our playbooks to make sure it's scalable, what we're doing, and that we can bring that platform to bear across the full portfolio very, very quickly. So we've got more than 20 value creation playbooks. And then it's actually the focus on that talent lever as well within the management teams. Yeah, it's not only internal talent, but it's that full ecosystem of talent, whether it be, as I say, our management teams and having the right management team in place to deliver that particular investment thesis, our advisors, and then also our kind of operating advisor bench that we can draw upon given the demands and nature of a situation. I think it's a lot more dynamic and tailored.
So I think often, you know, when we're, you know, as advisors from the outside, we really try to look at how the operating teams at each individual fund is structured. And to Sam's point, there's ways of sort of combining that senior advisor river guide role with the generalist operating partner, with the functional depth. You know, we obviously from an advisor standpoint say, hey, you know, let us carry some of that cost of capital for you, right? Like let us sort of maintain some of the arms and legs, but also be able to kind of reach into that, you know, deep bench. It's expensive, right, to keep a group of operating partners together and really be able to cover that breadth of the spectrum. So the question that we always ask, and a lot of the deal teams are asking, well, what is my fit for purpose operating team, right? And then you have to ask the question, well, what's the purpose? Are you executing multiple carve-outs and you're really creating a best-in-class operating team that can stabilize carve-outs, get you to a point where you can launch your VCP? Are you really building an operating team that's looking at more of a growth strategy and you need commercial senior advisors built on with functional capabilities? You know, I think to the extent that deal teams and sort of deal thesis and deal themes can be a bit more, you know, clear, I think it gives Sam and the operating team that capability to go build for like fit for purpose.
I fully agree with Paul, actually. We really see our operating team, as I say, as those strategic architects. And then it's very much a case of getting them the right leverage, you know, whether that's the right CTO within our portfolio, the right advisors, always kind of best in class across each of those areas is just totally key to how we run our value creation model.
Thank you. And Paul, are you seeing the uncertain environment having any impact on the types of exits happening in the market? Or perhaps the way that sponsors are engaging with businesses to prepare them for exit, or even the types of buyers that are in the market at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Sam mentioned earlier, there's a much closer correlation between these are the investment themes, this is what we think from a VCP upon acquisition, and really that question of, well, how do we build a better business? Right. So there has to be something where the asset that came in 4 or 5 years ago, the team, Sam, like built a better business and it no longer looks like what was there. I mean, there's still certainly the opportunities for some of these quicker turn, you know, 2-3 year exits, but those are becoming much, much harder. Right. So I think as you align that, what is that build? Right. Like what have we built? What is different about the business from the day that the asset came on? Where are we in that journey? Being really clear on what is that journey? Have we given the management team enough availability and space to go do that build a little bit unconstrained? And then when you get to exit, you want to do three things, right? You want to be able to clearly identify, show in the numbers and articulate why the business is better, right? So that sort of baselining. You want to be able to show on a plan that, hey, you're not all the way through the plan. This is where we are. This is, you know, what's left in terms of opportunities for the next owner that might have a, you know, slightly different platform, different approach that they can still pull. And then I think the third part is kind of coming back to that AI question, right? Like how have we made it more resilient so that the business is able to absorb some of these shocks and AI disruption, and the sort of plan that's being executed has been de-risked or at least more of a stable growth path. But I think it ultimately comes back to like, you've built a better business, take credit for it, and then being able to kind of show that path going forward, whether it's a public exit, sponsor to sponsor trade. You know, we've seen a lot of kind of dual processes, right? Kind of back to that optionality again. But in either path of that dual path or dual optionality, you need to be able to show those three things. We've built a better business. It's very much kind of resilient, and there's runway. There's like runway to go in these areas.
Sam, are you seeing similar trends here?
So no, we're seeing a lot of similar things, and it's not been easy, I think, for sponsors, and our LPs are incredibly focused on exits. You know, DPI is the new IRR. And so it's clearly something that private equity as a community is incredibly focused on. Yeah, you look at the latest Bain & Company report, I think there's 32,000 unsold assets within private equity portfolios. Average holds are creeping up to 6.5, 7 years, the longest on record. So there's a real imperative for sponsors to continue to transact. But I think, you know, we've seen IPO markets be tricky, windows opening and closing. We're seeing volatility there. And the sponsor market has been a little bit tricky as well for people in amongst this flight to quality that we've seen over the last couple of years because of all the disruption that's been in the market. So I think we're seeing very similar themes to what Paul talked about in terms of how you build a sought after asset. Essentially everything Paul summarized there is what's in our Fit for Exit scorecard, which is part of our portfolio review committee toolkit. When we think about exits, we think about them from day one, and we're really building all of the things that Paul talked about through time and holding our teams, you know, accountable on that. And I think a good example of that actually within our portfolio is Envu. So we recently sold a stake to GIC in Envu. And I think that was a business that we acquired out of Bayer. So it was a carve out. It was Bayer Environmental Science at the time. We acquired it in 2022. At that point, it was a really high quality business, differentiated products, high margins, but it was also very primary. So at that point, the business got a very significant portion of its supply from Bayer, and we needed to turbocharge the rate of organic growth within the platform, as well as execute on the separation and the carve out, which was pretty complex. So we had a lot of work to do, and we, you know, the team, they really focused on the kind of building blocks that would build a successful exit over time. And really they were focusing on, okay, let's get this supply chain dependency resolved and reducing the concentration of supply with Bayer. And then equally, as Paul said, you know, it was about building the equity story for the next leg and the next buyer, which we're very happy to be participating in that journey as well. And that was around M&A, and it was also around in-licensing as well to enhance organic growth. And we've managed to add 2 percentage points to the rate of organic growth through our hold period as well in what is a very resilient business. So we're very pleased with that. All of that came together to make a very, very attractive proposition for the next buyer. And that's obviously what incented GIC to do the deal with us. And the other sort of theme I wanted to draw out was the type of buyer that we think are super resilient through periods of volatility and through dislocated markets, and that's strategic buyers. So clearly, as Paul said earlier, a strategic is really looking for, you know, it might be looking to augment its current product portfolio. It might be looking for opportunities to cross-sell, or it might be looking for new market entry. Those things are very strategic to that buyer, and they're willing to look through near-term volatility. You know, it's not a pure financial play. And so we've been very, very focused on that strategic buyer cohort over the past couple of years. You know, we've done 50% of our full or partial exits over the last 2 years have been to strategic buyers. And then it's about transforming those platforms, just as Paul talked about, and really tailoring them to what the next buyer wants, speaking to the buyers, understanding their wants and needs, and tailoring the platform to that.
I love the way you're describing the focusing on what the buyer need is, right? That strategic buyer lens really is very bespoke to who that buyer is. The one theme that we've heard kind of throughout PE exits to strategics is the strategics want to understand, is this asset going to be a step change for me or not, right? Is it a step change into new market entry, a new product category, a new something that is significant enough for them to take on what ends up being incremental cost in their cost platform and structure to go serve that step change?
Great, thank you. And I just wanted to end our discussion on a sort of quick fire question. So if you could highlight one value creation issue that the market should be thinking about moving forward, what would it be? Sam, do you want to go first?
Yeah, it's tempting to say artificial intelligence, but I'm actually going to say talent, because I do think that artificial intelligence is an unbelievable technology, but I do think without that change management and talent enabling lens, you can't reap the benefits from that technology. And what's more, we've talked about disruption, we've talked about the need for agility, well, you need agile talent. So I really think it's talent.
Great, thank you. And Paul, what would you say?
So I'm going to parrot exactly what Sam mentioned, right? I mean, earlier in the conversation, we talked about having that sort of AI implementation and change management and adoption gap. And we brought up the issue of, you know, talent, right? Like talent and training and upscaling. I do think the one thing that shows up quite a bit now from a diligence perspective is traditionally you've looked at evaluation of talent at, you know, CEO, C-suite, L1, L2 sort of org, right? I think the more that there's an ability to evaluate and then track kind of all the way down through the organizational structure and really get to that, are they ready for change? Are they ready? You know, are they mature enough to be able to sort of upscale? That's really the next sort of evolution of getting certainty on conviction on, you know, executing VCP. Because Sam knows as well as anyone, I mean, everything looks great on paper. And then when you try to, you know, execute, that's really where the rubber meets the road. And talent is without a doubt the most important part to be able to go execute.
That again was KPMG's Paul Pan and Cinven's Sam Williams on the issues facing operating teams today and what's next for value creation strategies. This episode was edited by Eric Fish and produced by Evie Russman, Edward Cleaver, and Natalie Novikova. I'm Louise Fordham, reporting for Private Equity International. For more market insights, visit privateequityinternational.com or tune into Private Equity Spotlight wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.